This is an Area Code podcast.
All the design, level design, monster design, I'm like, yeah, that's me. And if it's not good, that's my fault. And yeah, when people come down really harsh on some of those decisions, or just like the art, right? Like you know, metro.co.uk said the game is visually unappealing, you know? And that's, that everything in there, I hand drew. Either I hand drew or I wrote the shaders to, you know, apply the graphical effects. And yeah, I mean, you read stuff like that and get panic attacks when I'm exposed to that kind of stuff, because it's like everyone struggles with imposter syndrome. And every time you read something like that, the voice in your head goes, now they know you're all a fraud, you know? And that's a thing that I deal with. That's the worst part of game development.
Episode of Video Game Feelings. Today, a conversation I'm really excited about. James Silva is an independent developer. He's now working with a partner, but he has been developing independently for years and years. And in particular, right now is well known for his Salt and series, Salt and Sanctuary, and then the sequel, Salt and Sacrifice, are two of his more recent games. Those are games that they're kind of bloody, kind of violent, but also fairly difficult. I first became aware of James Silva when his game, I Made a Game with Zombies in It, was released on the Xbox Indies store, which is a whole thing that we actually go into sort of right off the bat. You'll hear more about that later, but also the Dishwasher series. All of these are sort of like side-scrolly beat-em-ups with some Dark Souls elements, especially Salt and series. And so we had a really good conversation around, you know, difficulty in games and why he makes games that way, but also just interesting perspectives on like what it means to create a game and how you feel when that game is received in certain ways, in different ways. And so really enjoyed this conversation with James Silva, the one and only creator of I Made a Game with Zombies in It. Here we go. Well, I wanted to start by saying this. I just noticed that I want to talk about I Made a Game with Zombies in It, because this game was just put out on modern Xbox consoles again. I just discovered that today in doing research and got really excited, because that game like brings me back to Xbox 360 days. I think it was on the indie games store or something. What did they call that?
Xbox Live Indie Games. It was at first Xbox Live Community Games, and then it was rebranded Indie Games, and then it disappeared forever.
There were some real gems on that platform, and it's impossible to explain to people like what that platform was and why it was special and what it felt like, but it was the best way I can explain it is it felt kind of like a mobile game store before mobile games, but on Xbox a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've explained why it's special a lot, but it's way more special to the developer than to the gamer.
So
before Xbox Live Indie Games came around, if you were just some random person, you know, writing code in their pajamas in their apartment, and you wanted to deploy this code on a console, it was basically impossible. There was like a PS2 thing called Net Euros that you could use to deploy code on PS2, mm-hmm. but it was very a hobby. I mean, it, like, you could only access like 2 megabytes of RAM. I don't know. I mean, like, limited GPU. I don't know anything about it. I just know it was very, very limited and very, like, a hobbyist hack kind of system.
Yeah.
And then when Xbox Live Indie Games came around, it was like anyone could just be like, boom, deploy code on Xbox 360. Anyone around the world with an Xbox 360 can play the game that you made in your spare time for fun. And that never happened before. And so for a developer, that was awesome. For a gamer and for the press, they were like, why though? You know, I could play Gears of War. I could play Call of Duty. You know, for the press was like, oh, Microsoft's trying to do this. Look how many bad games are on here. Look how they play developers.
You feel like the reception was that bad to this platform?
Well, that's the part of the reception that sticks out in my mind, right? So that's the,
I can relate to that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to you know, what we were talking about before, like, there were a lot of games that people people really loved. And you don't want to characterize it as junk because these are people making games for fun in their spare time. Like, you know, if your kid draws a picture, you're not going to be like, that's garbage, I'm not going to pay for it, you know?
Yeah.
But people doing things out of passion, for fun, you know, just because they believe in themselves. I mean, you want to get behind that. But the narrative, I mean, the one I would see so much was like, this is Microsoft's thing. So all of the games we don't like are essentially Microsoft's failure, which is fun to talk about because it's fun to, you know, to be like, oh, Microsoft screwed up. You know, and then to gamers, it just goes back to like, why would I play this? I could be playing Gears of War. I could be playing Call of Duty. Like some games would be viral breakout hits. There were those Minecraft games before Minecraft came out.
Yeah,
but
interesting.
Yeah, I have a lot of opinions on Xbox indie games. Yeah, it was a good time.
Like my experience as a player and admittedly also as a games creator, critic at the time, like I was just starting to, like I was writing for Killscreen, I think at the time. And so I was very into games on that sort of like slightly, I don't know how you would call it. I don't really mean it this way, but I'm just going to say like slightly elevated or like conscious level, right? So I was really interested in exploring games. And what indie games, like that thing came along around the time, I want to say after like Braid came out. And Braid is a funny one just because of a lot of things now, but like at the time Braid blew my mind. And the reason it blew my mind was because for the first time in a long time, if ever, I felt like I was playing a game that was articulating one man's feelings. And that was really special to me. And I wanted more of that. And you really couldn't get much of that even then, because there was like a lot of the other Xbox arcade stuff was arcadey. You know, it was that sort of thing. And so not a lot of it felt as personal as I wanted it to feel. And so the Xbox Indies thing like really created this place where you knew for an absolute fact you were getting games that were made by individuals that had their fingerprint on it. And I made a game with zombies and it's such a great example of that. And people should just go play it. Like it's, if you have an Xbox, you can go play it right now. And it's like, you'll recognize, oh yeah, like this is a personal expression, right? I mean, just the title alone says a lot of it, but it's sort of like it's a one joke thing that really doesn't quite wear its welcome out. Like it somehow continues to work through the whole thing. And it's really fun and really well made, I think. So I think I wanted to bring that up just because of the way that game made me feel and the way that like indie games. And there are a couple others that I think about when I think about that platform. There was one, I don't remember the name, but you were like at a circus and you swung around. It's, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know the name of it. You're like an acrobat that swung around, like a not quite human acrobat. I can't remember.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't remember that one.
There was another one that was like half visual novel, half like DDR style game. And I think
that was probably Sequence.
Yes, Sequence. So I actually even reviewed that for Killscreen, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, by Jason Wishnov.
That seems familiar. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're friends in real life. I just saw him at PAX. Yeah,
he's beautiful. He's, what is he doing now? Is he making, what games is he?
He's working on something really cool that he has not talked about yet.
Okay.
Yeah, it's secret. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to get to the bottom. I'm going to Google that.
I hope me saying that is not a breach of trust. But yeah, he's working on something really cool.
Cool. Awesome. Well, we always start the show with one question, and is this, what have you been playing lately, and how has that game made you feel?
Oh, this might get me in trouble, but I've been playing Fallout 76 lately.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you know, I think it's on Game Pass, free on Game Pass. You know, actually, I played it at launch. It was obviously, you know, really bad at launch, just such an empty game. But, you know, when you play it with friends, that's a little more interesting.
Yep.
And then lately, I've been playing it just alone. I got into this routine where every morning, I like at 6:30, I go and run 4 miles, get home, and play Fallout for like an hour.
Man, then, that's kind of then, a beautiful work. Routine. I love that.
But yeah, Fallout 76, it's like I wanted something just like a turn mind off, just wander around, and it's casual-ish. It's not very intense. Because like Sekiro was a game I bounced off like twice. When I got through it third time, I finally finished it. And that was a game where it's just, I mean, you have to succeed, but your heart is racing. Like the sweaty palms.
Yeah,
at
yeah.
some point, I'm getting like a little bit too old for that just to enjoy that as like a pastime, right? Uh-huh. So I'm just like, I need some, you know, just wander around the wasteland and shooting mutants, right? I mean.
It's funny to think of Fallout 76 as chill, as like a chill
experience. It's very chill, yeah.
But yeah, I get what you're saying for sure. I played a little bit of it and like I don't know. I beat my head against the wall a few times. It's actually a little difficult for me, but it's one of those games that's interesting because, like, you sort of alluded to it there at the beginning where, like, the reception was not great. People seem to have a running vendetta against it. But clearly people are playing that game. Like, they are supporting that game for a reason, and lots of people seem to be living in it. And, like, with the benefit of hindsight, it feels like it was a good gamble making that game, you know, the way they did.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's a so when we launched Salt and Sacrifice, a lot of the feedback was less positive than Sanctuary. You know, Metacritic-wise, it's like a few points lower. It's not like a disaster, but, you know, you have people that are so invested in, they really love the Sanctuary model, and Sacrifice changed in a number of ways. You know, my business partner and I have been like, the dialogue we use is like, do we No Man's Sky it? Because, you know, I mean, like, when the game comes out and the feedback's negative and you're like, let's turn this around, you know. Or the other alternative is like, well, that was that, and, you know, let's just move on to a new game now. But we have been adding content, so, I mean, we're going down the path of No Man's Skying it. And, you know, at the same time, it wasn't a disaster when we launched it either. You know, it was a solid game. It still is a solid game. I mean, the one thing that the latest content update was looking to remedy, there were just certain play styles that weren't very feasible. So it was like, all right, let's just add some more stuff to kind of round out, you know, the potential play styles in the game. And, you know, I think reception's been pretty good.
Yeah, I'm so interested by, like, that conversation you're having. Do we No Man's Sky it? I'm curious if that's a business discussion or if that's a, like, a creative discussion. Are you weighing those options in terms of, will this pay off? Or are you weighing those options in terms of, like, is this going to make us feel more creatively fulfilled if we save this project?
Yeah, I mean, more to the latter, I think. Just, we want people to like us more, you know. I mean, we want to have a relationship with the community where it's like, look, we want you to enjoy the game. We want you to, you know, we don't want you to feel like, you know, it was a bad investment of your time mostly, but also your money, right? I mean, we want to feel creatively fulfilled. That was a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, we're basically just, we kind of both just work for free, right? So it's just like, let's put some more stuff in, just see what happens, right? In worst case scenario, it was fun.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't mind me asking, like, how do you justify the work for free thing? Like, are you not thinking about how to pay for what you do and that sort of thing? Like, in what sense? I guess maybe the question is, in what context are you having to think in a business direction versus the pure creative direction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it gets really, the whole thing gets really fuzzy, right? It's like, sure. Well, you know, what do you spend time on? I mean, the game was, it was a commercial success. So we're kind of like, okay, now we can relax a little bit, and whatever more time we put into this, that's fine, right? It's not a huge loss. But yeah, I mean, I think, like, the most important thing is just, is it commercially successful where we can go on and make more games? And we hit that point. So we're, you know, so the rest is all just details and what we feel like working on and why.
That's awesome. So, it sounds like the goal is to make a good game that enough people buy that you can then do exactly what you want.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I want to go back to Fallout because,
yes,
I mean, I still want to get, I'm still trying to feel out, like, what are you feeling when you play Fallout? Like, what is pulling you to it? And then what are the feelings that you're experiencing when you're playing it?
Yeah, right. I mean, like I said, it's really just kind of like a casual wind down kind of, you know, solitude, just exploring the wasteland, the 10-year-old graphics, which, I mean, I can't complain. I make indie games. But yeah, I mean, it's just a nice casual romp. I don't know.
You mentioned you've been playing it by yourself a lot, but you have played it with friends, right?
Like, yeah. A couple of years ago, I was playing, I think, like, around launch, I was playing with some friends a couple of years ago.
Does it feel like significantly, is there a huge contrast when you're playing by yourself? Is it, I guess what I'm wondering is, like, is there a loneliness that you're feeling walking around that world that is pronounced by having done it with other people before?
Could be. I mean, there's the solitude to it. You know, when you'd play it with other people, though, you'd kind of just all do whatever you felt like anyway. And then here and there, it's like, oh, come to my base. I put a new machine in or something. And then you go to their base, you see the machine. You're like, okay, well, I'm going to go, you know, do this other quest line, which at launch, the quest lines were all just like, go here, find a holotape, go here, find a holotape. They were pretty bad. I mean, they've actually like the quest lines they've added since then have, you know, NPCs and intrigue, which faction are you going to side with? You know, so it's more of that classic feel. It's amazing how janky it is though. Oh, geez. When you load a holotape, you see the fingers go into the Pip Boy to put that, but the holotape model, the mesh isn't even rendered. I don't even like the game. It's been out for so many years that for some reason the holotape is invisible. Like
there's an invisible holotape.
Yeah. Stuff like that. I mean, every conversation between NPCs is like just, it is more awkward pauses than actual dialogue. It's like they turn and then face each other and then adjust a little bit.
Right.
And then,
it's like a post-COVID simulator. Everybody's just gotten out of their rooms post-COVID lockdown and they don't know how to talk to each other anymore. And so they're just doing awkward pauses.
It's funny. I mean, I focus on an amount of polish in the games that I make, and like, you know, obviously I'm not 100% successful, but yeah, Fallout 76, it is missing a lot of polish, like so many years on. It feels like I also know how debugging and fixing released retail product goes, namely, you don't want to touch anything that could break something else. And so I get it, right? It's like, okay, we're going to fix how janky the dialogue is. And now this one whole critical path line is inaccessible because something else goes wrong. You know, yeah. I mean, it's so delicate. Once you're through Surat, you're released, it just feels like you're touching a house of cards every time you do any modifications.
Something you said about the way that you would play with other people is giving me, it's putting a theory in my head, and I'm curious if you could affirm or deny. Like, is it possible it feels more lonely to play with other people than to play by yourself? Because, like, you're supposed to be with friends. This is, like, a reflection of sometimes how life is, right? Like, you're supposed to be among all these people, but you have totally different objectives and goals that you're trying to do, and, like, you're pretending to care about other people. But then even the holotape thing, like, you get a holotape and then you listen to it and you're just not paying attention to anyone else. You're like listening to that specific holotape you found. Like, it's shocking to me that would be the primary purpose in that game, having made it a multiplayer thing. But I don't know. To me, it feels like it would be a really lonely experience playing that with other people.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Aside from meeting up, you know, there was one point, you know, where for a while I was playing with, you know, Danny B, the musician. Like, he did I think he did the Crypt of the Necrodancer music.
Oh, cool. Okay.
But yeah, for a month, I was playing with him a bunch way back when. So he had a bass that had a bunch of musical instruments lined up, so we'd all play music together, which, you know, it's like fun for a minute, right? But then, yeah, you go back to just quest lines, and it's just solitude again. And the way I've been playing it lately, because I'm just playing by myself in a server populated with 23 other people, whenever you see them, you're like, just leave me alone, dude. I'm doing something else, right?
That is the way I felt when I played it. Like, when I played Fallout 76, I was very much like, I would see someone walking around and literally, like, avoid them, which is very true to life, very too much like normal life. Like, I'm in the supermarket, I see someone I know, and I'll go to the other aisle real quick. That's kind of the vibe I got from Fallout 76. Anytime I saw a real human walking around, it was strange. Feeling. I'm curious if you could tell me a little bit about, like, your earliest experiences playing games. Like, what's the first time you can remember playing video games?
Oh, yeah. It was Atari. I don't know if it was 2600 or, I mean, I was very young. It had, you know, wood paneling and a joystick with one button.
I feel like it's probably 2600. That's what I started with too.
Yeah, yeah. And it could even be a sentimental memory because it was at my grandma's house when I was like six, seven, eight. You know, she's passed. All my grandparents are passed since then. Mm. And so, yeah, growing up playing, I was, you know, Combat, Pitfall with my sisters and my cousins. You know, it was pretty cool. And then maybe a year or so later, my parents bought me and my sisters a Nintendo. And that was, from then on, I was pretty much hooked. I loved Zelda. Legend of Zelda was like, I mean, it took over my imagination, you know? You know, and you up-res it in your imagination too. I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing that we've lost with games now that games are how they're meant to look, right? I mean, take like Contra for Nintendo. Everything is a representation of what would be a, you know, like a Gears of War type or a Call of Duty type game, right? You know, that's how we'd see it now. But if you look at Contra for Nintendo, how do you mentally up-res it? Do you make it cartoony? Do you make it cel-shaded? Do you make it like grim dark? And I up-res Zelda as like a Dark Souls game in my like 8-year-old mind, right? So it's just like these dark gothic dungeons and like blades coming out and just chopping everyone up left and right. Like that's how I up-resed it. You know, it turns out now we see what up-resed Zelda looks like, and they went with cel-shaded, very kind of, you know, it's like a Pixar, like a lot of colorful smoke and effect. That's how Nintendo had it to up-res Zelda. So I learned.
I feel like games were a lot more like books in that way back in the day. Like the thought that came to my mind when you talk about up-resing is like we kind of got a running start on it with covers. Like the game boxes would have these. And people mock those because they'll say that wasn't what the game looks like, but they're missing the point. They do the same thing that like a Harry Potter cover would do, which is say, this is generally what those people look like and what the vibe of this game. Now project all of that onto these pixels or words or whatever it is, right, that you're about to engage with. And I feel like that was definitely something that was really valuable back then.
I loved it. I always like to tell the story of, so when I was growing up, I was playing so much Nintendo. My mom was like, okay, this is going to be a weekends only thing. No Nintendo on weekdays. She stuck to that. There was no wiggle room.
Was it a homework issue? You just didn't do your homework?
I remember specifically it was because we would come home from school and go straight to the TV to play Zelda. And she did not like that. She wanted, some more. It seemed like it was just taking over our minds, taking over our lives, and she was uncomfortable with that. But we had this PC. It was like a 286. It had 1 megabyte of RAM, like a 10 megabyte hard drive, floppy disk drive, the 5 1/4 inch floppy disk drive, and it had BASIC, the programming language. And so I learned how to make these text adventures with BASIC, and that was basically a way to make a game, to play a game, and it didn't fall under the no Nintendo rule. And so I spent so many days just learning this and that, and that's really what got me kind of hooked on, because I understood how logic flow worked at that age, and that really got me hooked on programming. And I'm still an awful programmer, but, I've kicked out a few games in my time.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it feels like that would be a pretty formative experience growing up. How did your mom react to that? Was she like, you're finding loopholes and breaking the rules, or was she
no, that was all good. That was fine.
She encouraged it.
I think it might have still made her a little uncomfortable because I was enjoying it so much.
Aaron, that is a thing where, as a parent, when you're like, when a kid becomes obsessed with something, you're like immediately like, you are too obsessed, especially when it gets in the way of other things. You're just like, but as an adult, I think I'm sort of like, personally, as the dad of a 7-year-old who's currently rushes home to play Overwatch 2, I'm like having to sort of balance those two things where it's like, it shouldn't be like taking precedence over everything, but it's actually a good thing to love something, it's a nice thing to love something so much you're kind of obsessed with it a little bit.
I know my, how does this work? My aunt and then her daughter's kids. So she's the grandma to these kids. I don't know if it's what your cousin's kids are to you. But anyway, those kids, maybe the kid was like 10 or so. And he was playing Fortnite. And my aunt was just so pleased that he was like being mature about like coordinating team efforts and, game, guys, good strategy. She was so pleased about that. She thought that games were all just pretty mindless. And then when she realized it was like, it was a social experience, it involved tactics and organization and leadership, she was pretty happy with that.
Yes, totally.
I mean, I haven't played Overwatch since 1. I played 1 for a while, and then, I don't know, been at least 3 years, so I don't know. I don't know how the world of Overwatch has changed since then. I know it's 5v5, not 6v6.
I couldn't even begin to tell you how much it's changed. It's crazy. I mean, a lot is exactly the same, but then so much is different. And it's just gone into like faster and more action-oriented approach. Overwatch is definitely one of those games that is a little bit more cerebral or strategic, if you want it to be, which is fun to watch Atticus engage with how to play different characters and stuff like that. So that's been cool. When you were a kid, why did you play games? What were you getting out of them? What did you go to them for?
Let's see. They're something new, exciting, exploring them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm curious, right? What is something that like is better about just, you know, satisfying your curiosities than a video game? It's all these moving parts. It's its own model of physics. It's its own, it's all these systems that you can explore. There's just so much to them. I'm also an introvert, you know, just having that little world to explore without the fear of social ramifications is it's a good place, right? It's a comfortable place. It's an exciting place. And, also being just a person with that creative blood, like I was like, I want to make my own places. I like exploring these other places. I want to make my own places with my own rules and my own, you know, my own NPCs. And yeah, so that's how that started. I used to draw pictures of like, here's a Nintendo game I'm going to make. It's like Mega Man, but different right. in these ways, right? And you draw out maps on some graph paper and you're like, oh, okay, I did a lot of work here. I guess I can mail this to Nintendo and they'll make a game out of it. And how does that work, you know?
Right, yes, right. That's what we all did. 100%. Oh, man. My friends and I spent a lot of time coming up with Mortal Kombat fatalities. Like that which I think is like the lowbrow version of what you just articulated.
Well, I used to make flip books of Mortal Kombat fatalities.
Nice. Nice. I love it.
Yeah, the animations where you flip them and yeah.
I still feel like that's got to be the best job in video games, is like just being in the writer's room or whatever, where they talk about what the fatalities should be and like just spitball stuff.
Yeah, oh, there man. Was a, I swear I saw an article about that where, yeah, they would literally, what you describe is what would happen is they're
right.
Just...
I read that somewhere and that's why that popped in my head. Like I need that job so bad. Sure I'd leave very uncomfortable after half of it, but man.
Yeah, yeah. Probably you have to determine some lines that can't be crossed before the dialogue starts.
I guess.
Figure out some boundaries. Yeah.
I guess, but I feel like in the right, like both there and also just like in TV writing and stuff, I feel like people talk about those spaces as places where you experiment with the line a little
right,
bit.
Right, right, right.
Not to the point where like, I mean, there are certain obvious lines, but in general, like, I feel like you can experiment a little bit. But Mortal Kombat in particular pushes those boundaries. So, I mean, the time I saw, I think Johnny Cage uses someone's head as a puppet. That stuff is wild.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've seen that one. Yeah, that's. I'm getting, like, old to the point where I'm just like, is this necessary? geez. Especially because they're all family. You know, there's so many family members in the game now. Like, there's like Johnny Cage and Cassie Cage, and they're like, all right, time to spar. And then, you know, you cut to one of them just like murdering the other one in like a horrific way. Right. Like, that's so weird. Like, how can these be heroes? How can you root for anyone who does that? It's just, it's so bizarre.
I agree with you in a sense, but also Mortal Kombat made such a conscious decision to move so far beyond the world of caring about those questions that it's like, you have to respect it at some point. But so I'm curious how much that reason that you played as when you were a kid, how much has that changed or evolved over time? What is different now about what you go to video games for?
Well, so Fallout is the decompress. Before then I beat Elden Ring a couple times yeah. Okay. I had a few characters, and then, you know, you find some, like, you're like, oh wait, this weapon is really good, I want to do a run with this one, you know. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's the exploration, it's the challenge. You know, lately it's been the decompress. You know what, God of War just came out, right? I should get that. I really liked the last one.
Everyone's talking about that one, and I just don't have a PlayStation, so I'm convincing myself I don't care.
Oh, okay.
You know how it is.
I've heard it's awful, yeah.
It's supposed to be really good, and if people play it and come on the show and talk about it, it'll be fun, but yeah.
I saw a tweet where it was like, because the last God of War was a 94 Metacritic, and the new God of War is 94 Metacritic, and someone tweets, can't even improve on the last one, shaking my head. It's just like,
That's funny. So what's interesting to me, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about difficulty, because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like your games are kind of hard sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's a distinguishing thing about your games.
which kind of puts me in a space of hypocrisy, right? If I'm playing games to relax now, and then I'm like, but my games should be really hard. So what happens is it's a little bit unintentional, and then like at some point you might lean into it. But when you're making a game, you get so just familiar with the mechanics, with all of the game, it gets really easy. And when it gets really easy, it gets really boring. And when it gets really boring, you start to wonder, is anyone else going to find this interesting? So you start tweaking the difficulty so you're not bored. And then you're like, oh, okay, this feels good. I just scraped through that fight. That's good. I mean, that's how I'm playing Dark Souls 3, Bloodborne, Elden Ring. I just scraped through that fight. That was good. My heart's racing. You know, my palms are sweaty. That's good. And so that's how the game will be when I think it's at a good place. That might be way too hard for everyone else. And that's one of those things that you're always going to suck at gauging. You know, I mean, it'd be nice to do a better job of gauging it, but it's always going to be hard. In fact, I wonder if like Salt and Sacrifice might have been like, right now I'm like, it is what it is. It's in a good place. But we didn't demo it at PAX because the pandemic happened. Prior to that, you know, every game I've made, like I've showed at PAX a bit, and you know, you just get a sort of steady stream of people who you get to watch them play it, see how they interact with whatever challenges or you know, attack patterns or whatever, and then you can be like, oh yeah, this is too hard, let's, you know, rein this in a little bit. But yeah, with this one, it was all, you know, we had some friends playing it and just kind of like reporting in, but never that sort of, you know, over the shoulder experience where you're just kind of watching every moment.
That's a big difference too. Like it seemed like that would be a really key thing for understanding really how people play. I can imagine actually telling people, like having to tell you actively what I struggled with and what I thought about specific things. And it would be hard to be honest with myself, I think, about that.
Now, I will say for Salt and Sanctuary, I went through a QA house to do just QA testing on that. And the QA house, they offered UX testing where they would get 10 volunteers, sit them down on a couch, camera is watching them the whole time. And you know, a feed of the gameplay, and the player is coming through a, you know, YouTube private closed circuit whatever feed, and I can watch that. So we did that. We did UX testing.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And there were 10 people. One of them was a Dark Souls fan. The other 9 were just like, "Oh yeah, video games, sure, sounds fun." What happened was the 9 who didn't care for Dark Souls, they were like, this game is frustrating. It's awful. I didn't feel any satisfaction when I finally beat the boss. It's just, you know, I'm just so annoyed with everything about this. There was a gal who was a Souls fan. She loved it. She was just like, you know, she maybe like died to the first boss one or two times, but then learned the patterns and then won. Just, yes. And like, you can see now she's exploring more and she's like, oh, okay, if I can go this way. And when it was over, she was talking to the test proctor and, the guy's like, all right, yeah, thank you for your time. You know, if we have any questions, well, and she's like, oh, I went here and I did this and then I got stuck here. And I like, she just wanted to keep talking about it. She was so excited. And like, that was a form of validation of like, you know, stick with what you want to play rather than what you think will please everyone. And so that experience really shaped how I went into the difficulty on Salt and Sacrifice. I was just like, we got to play for the one gal that's into Dark Souls, not the 9 who are interested in the casual. And, you know, again, it's like you never know how much you're hitting and missing. But that was the mentality, and that was the game that we made.
Yeah, I love that insight and that mentality. It does raise a question for me, though, that I really want to talk about, which is, what is the difference, do you think, between her and those other 9 people? And the reason I want to raise this is because I'm in that second category, to be totally honest.
Like the 9 people?
I have never liked the Souls games. I loved what I played of Elden Ring, but quit after the first boss. Like, I was like, this is too hard. I'm frustrated. I'm going to move on to something. And frankly, I'm in a mode in my life now where I'm sort of defaulting to the easy mode, which is weird, a weird feeling. Because when you talk about easy as boring, I don't experience that because I just want to get somewhere, experience something. I just want to progress. And I'm curious, like, what do you think the difference is there between those two people? And it's okay if you say we're wusses or something. Just can't handle it.
So for one, the easiest boring thing, what's happening with that is when you're playing a game, you're exploring something you haven't seen before. So if there's no real difficulty, that's fine. You're still exploring this world. If it's a game that you made, you know what the world looks like.
Yeah, true.
You are intimately familiar. You spend, you know, for every minute of gameplay, you've spent hours and hours just, you know, drawing and modeling and all that stuff. So that part is just completely uninteresting. And then what's left is the actual, you know, gameplay difficulty. And so if that's boring, if that's not challenging, well, then what have you got, right? And that experience that every player has the first time of experiencing something new, you will never get that. You'll never experience that. And in a way, it's kind of a tragedy that comes with it. You know, you make a game you want to play, but then you can never experience it the first time like other people can.
Yeah. Do you play your games like after they're released?
Here and there, usually just to do more work on them. By the time I'm done with them, I've already spent, with Salt and Sacrifice, I did so many different build playthrough runs where each one, maybe like 12-hour run each time, so I'd have like a 12-hour run going, and then I'm like tweaking things as I'm going through, and then and then try another one. And it was a lot, right? It's when you spend 16 hours a day, 7 days a week crunching to get it out there, it changes, it alters the nature of the relationship with the game, I guess. Yeah. You could say.
Yeah.
But I didn't answer your question about, like, is there a critical difference between the people that want really challenging games and those that don't? And, it's funny, I circle back because I don't have an answer. I don't know. I mean, I'll say the game that got me hooked on that kind of a system was probably Devil May Cry 3. And it's just, the satisfaction that comes through mastery, because it's a game that it demands an amount of mastery. And then when you can, you have to teach yourself, you have to learn that mastery somehow. And when you achieve that mastery, being able to employ it feels like you've accomplished something that otherwise would be missing. So like a Call of Duty game, I know I'm going to get from A through a million corridors to Z, and then we're done, right? With Elden Ring, I don't know if that's going to happen, because there will be challenges there that I will not know how to surpass, and I'll have to learn on my own. Right. And that makes it somehow more special, because you have that sort of ownership over it. So maybe, okay, I do have an answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like there's like something, I'm asking this question knowing the answer to some degree, right? It's all like seasonal, right? It's got to be. I mean, even you talked about like having moments where you like a chill experience with Fallout 76. And importantly, that moment comes after you've just done a run, which I assume is its own challenge. And so you're experiencing, like, you've already done the challenge. Now you need a cool down, right? I feel like my life is made up of really struggling to accomplish much. And so when I go to a game, and like the thing I've talked about, I think multiple times on this podcast now, is going to a game and not being able to accomplish something in the game, and it's really sucking. Like, that's an Overwatch experience. That's why I don't play much Overwatch myself very much these days, is because, like, when I started playing competitive, it meant nothing else mattered. And then when you play competitive and you lose, it's like I just wasted that time and nothing was accomplished, and maybe I level up my character or something, but that doesn't mean anything. And it can be really discouraging to have no feeling of accomplishment compared to, frankly, Dreamlight Valley. I go like get the things I'm supposed to get and build the house, and I feel accomplished. Even though it's like literally the easiest objective on earth, I at least get to feel like I checked that off the list,
Yeah. And I wonder if video games are kind of hacking our brains these days, because we have this, this like primitive instinct to like hoard and build. And they're like, now you have more things. You got more things. You did some work and you got more things. And you're like, yes, my instinctive drive has been fulfilled. I did some work and I got more things.
That's right. Yes. So for this game that is coming out, Salt and Sanctuary? Right?
So Salt and Sacrifice, that's the latest game. And we just launched it in May 10th on PS4, PS5, and EGS. So that's the first game that I made with my new business partner, Shane. We've been kind of like longtime D&D buddies. We've been like, a campaign, well, several different campaigns, but the same group that's been going for like, I don't know, 6-7 years maybe. And, we've been friends for a while. He used to volunteer at PAX for Ska Studios. And then we actually ended up forming a new studio called Devoured Studios, which is what Salt and Sacrifice is released under. And so we got to... He got to finally exhibit at PAX, showing a game that he made in part. He's a software engineer, and then I'm used to just kind of doing everything, but he's a way better coder than me, so he did all the netcode, and I got to focus on more like just art, animation, level design, weapon design, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm curious, like when you guys put out this game, like what was at stake for you on a personal level? Like, what were your personal feelings around this game, and like, what did you need from the release of this game for it to feel like a success?
You know, there was a lot of pride at stake. Yeah, I mean, because it was, you know, Salt and Sanctuary was 2016. It was the best performing game I've ever created. It really just became a runaway success. And Salt and Sacrifice, you know, has to, the question is, can it live up to it? How does it live up to it? And, you know, to a lot of people, the answer was, no, it doesn't live up to it. Salt and Sanctuary is better in every way. And, but a lot of people do really like Salt and Sacrifice as well. It's just, there are differences to it. Like the play feels a little bit different. A lot of the mechanics are different. But, you know, there are core elements that are the same. And, it's a weird feeling to go, you know, 6 years. Like, I used to release a game every like 2.5 years. And then it's weird to go like 6 years and then like, all right, new game. And, you know, you're like, do I still got it? Right. You know, yes. And like, yes. And to those people who are like, no, you screwed up. It's like, oh, gosh, you know, I don't have it anymore. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. You know? And you said earlier, I even wrote it down because it just struck me, resonated with me as the word. We want people to like us more. And I really relate to that. It's sort of what motivates a lot of what I do, for better or worse, probably worse. But like, I feel like if that were, I mean, it has happened to me. And in those moments, I feel genuinely like I have depression afterwards. And I'm curious if you experienced some of that sort of like reeling
after
that feedback.
There are a lot of emotional consequences to game development in the way that I do it. I'm sure in other ways as well. You're very exposed and very vulnerable. I mean, it's pretty much everything you see with the design of Salt and Sacrifice. That's a reflection of my ability. I didn't do the music, and that's why the music is incredible. I didn't do a bit of the writing, and I think that writing is also way better than the writing that I did. Hopefully it's not that much of a glaring difference where it all looks like it's from the same person. And I didn't do the netcode, and the netcode is absolutely solid. Everything else, all the design, level design, monster design, I'm like, yeah, that's me. And if it's not good, that's my fault. And yeah, when people come down really harsh on some of those decisions, or just like the art, right? Like you know, metro.co.uk said the game is visually unappealing, you know? And that's, everything in there, I hand drew. Either I hand drew or I wrote the shaders to, you know, apply the graphical effects. And yeah, I mean, you read stuff like that and get a panic attacks when I'm exposed to that kind of stuff, because it's like everyone struggles with imposter syndrome. And every time you read something like that, the voice in your head goes, now they know you're all a fraud, you know? And that's a thing that I deal with. That's the worst part of game development. And I hear your podcast is about video game feelings. Those are my video game feelings. You become very vulnerable when you're a tiny team making all the decisions, making all the content. And then people are like, all that stuff you did was bad. You know, it just hits hard.
I mean, that is the downside of being able to make a game that is all you, right? I mean, this is creative work in general. When you're able to pour yourself into a creative project, it's really fulfilling to make that thing, really fulfilling when people love it, and life breaking when people don't care or hate it.
Yeah. And the fact that the people don't care option, that didn't happen in any, you know, in any new way. Like, yeah, I mean, the games that I make are pretty niche. So the average amount of people don't care anyway, right? The people who, you know, again, Call of Duty, Overwatch, Destiny, like those are their games. They're not going to give any time to an indie game. But like, oh, the people who do care, they still cared, right? It wasn't just like sales plummeted, right? It had a healthy amount of sales ongoing, you know, it still has a healthy amount of sales. It's just one bit of feedback that always stings a little is, you know, the why can't this just be like the first game?
Which is, it's fascinating to me because, and again, relatable, but there's a tension there between what you're articulating now and you're making a game for that one person who actually liked this thing. Like, you're not making it for that nine. I think you said, especially with the second game, that was your shift, right? And so in a way, those negative reviews are just mean you succeeded in your goal, right? I mean, isn't that...
Well, so, okay, the 1 out of 10, that was for Salt and Sanctuary, the 2016 game. Yeah. Both games wanted to appeal to that niche, you know, the Souls-like player. So, yeah, actually, you know, with people who didn't like Salt and Sacrifice, a lot of those were in that 1 out of 10 who were like, you know, this game gets me, right? And then Salt and Sacrifice comes out and they're like, no, you screwed it all up.
And you felt like you maybe let them down or something.
Exactly.
I misunderstood what they were wanting. Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, it's tough. You know, you make games that you want to make and you can't please everyone. And Salt and Sanctuary really, it just did something for a lot of people. And, you know, Salt and Sacrifice, people really like it too. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a number of people who are like, why isn't this game not more like the first one? And that sticks out, right? Anytime you don't please everyone, that's the one. You can get 10 bits of positive feedback, but then one person who's like, it's not fun, that's the one that you remember. Uh-huh. You don't remember the 10. That's just the nature of it. And
I'm trying to connect the dots here between things that we haven't connected, but not arbitrarily, but because I think there's a relationship between the experience you're articulating and this interest and challenge and mastery. And I don't know, maybe you can help me out, but it feels like that feeling of like knowing you can work really hard at something and achieve, and there's an unquestionable success at the end, is maybe like the payoff that is sort of impossible on the creative side. Because the creative side is so ambiguous. Like, what do people want? And like, what does success look like? Who knows? It's really just about self-expression. And
yeah, but I think the mastery side of it, from the development side, it's because that's where it gets fun as the developer, when you need that mastery. Yeah. And then how does that fit with the creative side? I don't know. As a developer, it all comes back to like, I want to not be bored when I'm playing this. Like, if something ever is boring, I'm like, no, I have to make this more interesting. I have to add more, you know, but make more things to be worried about that might kill you, and you know, make more ways to kill other things, and gotta keep fleshing it out until everything feels just a little bit everything can kind of like put you on edge, right? Everything has a different pattern.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for sharing that. I do appreciate it. It's hard to talk about these topics sometimes, and I appreciate you sharing it.
Sure.
The last question we always do is we spin the feelings wheel. The feelings wheel is made up of 80 something different kinds of feelings that sort of are outgrowths of the sort of basic inside feelings, you know? And so every one of these feelings is unique and different, and we're going to spin the wheel and land on one. And I'd like you to tell me a game that has made you feel that way.
Okay. Is Schadenfreude one of the feelings? How granular do they get?
You know, they get relatively granular, and Schadenfreude is a really important one to me. I'm a big fan of Schadenfreude, actually. But in this case, we got empty as a feeling.
Empty.
So that's pretty granular.
Yeah. What is a game that made me feel empty?
What's a game that's made you feel empty? Which is, I love that one so much. That's maybe my favorite one I've landed on so far.
Oh, geez. You know, spoiler alert, I guess. I would maybe The Last of Us Part 2.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. You get to the end of it. Have you not played it?
I feel like I have. I could maybe guess what the ending is the way people have talked about it, but I've never had. Let's just talk about it. Just tell me what happens at the end, and we'll warn people.
You want to know?
Hey, I want to know. Because, I don't have a PlayStation. I'm never going to play this game.
It's really murdery, though. That's the amazing. It's got incredible art design. It's just so, it's so just fierce and so detailed, but you know, there are zombies, but there are also other scavengers, survivors, other humans. And you know, there's a lot of emphasis on like, look, you're doing what you can to survive, but you know what, so are they, and they have friends and they have families. And like, you know, when you kill someone, you'll hear someone like, they're like, she got Todd, she killed Todd, Todd's dead, you know. And you're like, oh, he's got a name now, you know. Like, they really get they really just twist that knife. But yeah, I mean, it's a story about revenge, and it's basically the revenge cost the protagonist everything. And she doesn't, you know, and the spoiler, she doesn't really even get her, like, when she's at that moment, she's like, no, I can't do this. So she doesn't get her revenge, and she loses everything she had anyway. And it just ends up, the final scene, it's such a, yeah, if you wanted to take the word empty and show it in a picture, there. So there's a guitar, you know, the guitar is how she connects to Joel. He taught her guitar. Joel is, you know, massive spoiler territory. Joel dies in like the first hour, so everyone was upset about that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so Joel's dead. She wants to get revenge on Joel's killers. And, you know, here and there, it comes back to the guitar, you know, flashbacks of playing guitar with Joel. You know, she's playing guitar with her new girlfriend. And the way they do the guitar, it's so, the wood is old. It's just so well done. Like, it's, and, you know, when she's trying to get her revenge at the end, when she's almost trying to kill, she ends up, the girl she's getting revenge on bites her fingers off. She loses two fingers. And the final scene when she's back home, her girlfriend left her girlfriend, you know, had a kid. The kid's gone. The girlfriend's gone. The house is empty. She has her guitar. She goes to play the guitar. And with her missing fingers, it just comes out wrong because it's empty. It's just such a, So I just spoiled it for you. I robbed you of that experience. You asked me to. This was not my fault.
I'm glad to finally have it spoiled because I've heard so many people allude to it. And it's, you know, let's get it out of the way.
Sorry to the listeners who haven't played it either. It is a brutal game. I think I've played through it twice. I've even like had a playthrough playing while it was working just as kind of like background noise. Cause it's like, I wanted to, you know, experience it again, but without playing it myself.
Yeah.
And then after I did that, I ended up playing it myself again anyway. Cause it's a really good game. It's just, oh man, it leaves you empty.
Yeah, I guess this is not a unique thing to video games. I guess this applies to all art forms, but it's just striking me now, like how much we play. I mean, you talking about going back and playing it through again after feeling empty at the end, how much we opt in for negative emotions when we play games. Like, and again, like we do this in all media, like we go to movies to cry sometimes or feel scared. But for games, it feels a little bit unique, especially as we talk about the challenge piece. Like it makes me wonder how much people actually like failure sometimes. Like this whole time we've been trying to like say it's all about achieving something after it failing multiple times. But part of me wonders if there is just a masochistic element to it where you just...
Yeah. I mean, I've rewatched Requiem for a Dream a few times. I mean, that's a movie that just leaves you gutted.
I will never watch that one again. That one I watched in college and was like, well.
Yep. Enough of that.
It's kind of funny that in all this time I've spent thinking about how games make people feel, I really haven't spent a ton of time thinking about how a game makes its maker feel. In particular, I'm really fascinated by that idea that James was talking about of a game becoming sort of less and less interesting over time to its developer, to its designer. And as a result, the designer doing really whatever he can to make it more interesting. That's a pretty like noteworthy and honorable impulse to me, because whenever I start feeling bored by something I'm making, I tend to just give up on it. I release it and move on, or I shelve it for later. And there's something just really admirable about James' impulse to invest more and more into the creation to make it less boring to a person who really would be most bored to it because they're most familiar with it. And he's sort of like trying to make sure it lives up to what is feels like to me, frankly, an impossible standard. But James, I think, can have that impulse because the games he's working on are genuine reflections of who he is. They're not like watered down by monetization strategies or meddling from upper management or the publisher. I feel like starting with I made a game with zombies in it, all the way to now, James has had this laser focus of making exactly the kind of games he wants to play, which the more I talk to him, the more I realize just how rare that is. This has been Video Game Feelings. Thanks for listening. If you want to check out our show more regularly and you're not already subscribed, please do subscribe to the podcast. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, any of the podcast apps that you like to use. Check out our Twitter also. We'll let you know every time we have a new episode there, so you're never out of the loop. Check us out on Twitter at @VidGameFeelings. Oh yeah, if you are enjoying the show, please rate, review us. Tell your friends, tweet about us. I love like positive affirmation. It makes me feel good. That's why I play video games. They're always affirming me. Be my video game. Affirm me. I appreciate it. Thanks, y'all. Have a good week. See you next week.
This is an Area Code podcast.